Thank you for listening, and welcome to the Titans of History series. Episode 48, The Coruña Campaign. Welcome back, everyone, and it's good to be speaking with you again. I know it's been a few months since our last episode, and again, I do apologize for that. Baby duties, full-time job, and a lot of other things going on outside the podcast obviously put this on the back burner for a little while, but we're getting into a smoother rhythm here, and I'm hoping to have a much more consistent schedule regarding the Titans of History moving forward. I don't think we'll ever get back to having an episode a week like we did when I first started, but not at least until the baby girl is a little bit older, although I'm hoping we can at least get to 2 a month now that we're on a better day-to-day routine, until, of course, that all changes, as I'm sure many of my listener parents know. But having said that, we're still here, and we're going to get through this however long it takes. So, with that said, let's move on to the next chapter in our story, the Coruña campaign, with a little bit of Catalonia sprinkled in. Ready? Here we go. Now, we've got a lot to cover today, which is good since I've had plenty of time to write the script for this episode, but it will be the last one on the Peninsular War for a little while. So I want to make sure we set the stage correctly, as we're going to be jumping around quite a bit between the Coruña campaign in the west and the rest of the 1808 Catalonia campaign in the east. Speaking of which, and I do apologize, I had made reference in our previous episode on the Battle of Cardedeu, and talking about it at the end of the episode, which, obviously, I did not do. So I apologize for that snafu, but we will be speaking on it in this episode, which actually works out better because it will tie in nicely to the rest of what we will be speaking about today, which is the dire situation the Spanish faced, now with Napoleon having retaken Madrid. We ended the last episode with Napoleon's convincing victory at Somosierra and the fall of the Spanish capital city to the Grande Armée, allowing the French emperor to reinstall his brother back on the throne in early December. Now, Napoleon would stay in Madrid for a couple of weeks to oversee the transfer of power, see his massive army was stationed all over the capital, and the ruling junta would flee south to Seville, where they would stay until January of 1810. Northern and central Spain had been pacified, and the capital was now in French hands, but that didn't mean that the war had ended. No, not by a long shot. And indeed, waiting in the wings to both the west and the east was the British Army and the Royal Navy, respectively, and with Napoleon now firmly entrenched on the Iberian Peninsula, the British realized that they could not afford to waste any more time on their front, lest they be pushed out of Spain and Portugal completely. Leading the British Army in Portugal was Lieutenant General Sir John Moore, who we'll remember took command after the recall of Harry Berard, Hugh Dalrymple, and Arthur Wellesley following the Convention of Sintra in August of 1808. Now, if you need a refresher, please refer back to our full episode on Arthur Wellesley, which discusses the entire controversy. But Moore was, in my opinion anyway, the British Army's answer to the Royal Navy's Horatio Nelson, and we'll understand why at the end of this episode. And so I think it would be prudent to do a quick intro on one of the main players of our discussion today, Sir John Moore. Moore was born in Glasgow, Scotland, in November of 1761, so he was close to a full generation older than Napoleon was, and his career in the military reflected as such. His father, also named John, was a famed doctor and travel writer, and Moore received his education in Scotland and eventually Geneva. Being a member of the nobility, he joined the British Army in 1776, and he saw his first action during the American Revolutionary War, being stationed in Nova Scotia before returning to Great Britain and being elected as a member of Parliament. Now, once the French Revolution kicked off, Moore was assigned to the Mediterranean, and he would take part in the British invasion of Corsica in 1794, invited to do so by Napoleon's childhood hero, Pasquale Paoli. After some disagreements with the British leadership on his position in the army, he was sent to the Caribbean, where he played an instrumental role in seizing St. Lucia from the French. After returning to Britain, he was promoted to Major General in 1798 and saw action in the Irish Rebellion of 1798, the Anglo-Russian invasion of the Netherlands in 1799, and then in Egypt against Napoleon's forces until 1801. Moore was lauded for his leadership, tactical command, and bravery during these campaigns, even being seriously wounded during the invasion of the Netherlands, but he was able to make a full recovery. His prowess caught the attention of the British High Command, and after his return from Egypt, he was tasked with the home defense of the British Isles, with the threat of a Napoleonic invasion looming. Of course, that never came to pass, but Moore is credited with the construction of the various Martello Towers which dot southern England even today. Now, when it became clear that Napoleon was shifting his strategy and turning his attention back to Central Europe, Moore was eventually promoted to Lieutenant General and sent to the Baltic to help assist the Swedes in the Finnish War, which is also a side story to the Napoleonic Wars, but we'll get to that a different day. But almost as soon as he landed in Sweden, Moore was sent back due to disagreements he had with King Gustav IV. From here, in July of 1808, he was sent to Portugal as the Iberian Peninsula was now engulfed in Napoleon's war. Now this roughly brings us back to where we are in the Napoleonic narrative. After Wellesley and Company's recall to London, Moore was put in charge of the British Army in Portugal, and he was then tasked with defending the peninsula from French conquest at any cost. Gathering strength from the British garrisons already posted there, as well as from local militias in Portugal and Spain, Moore headed up the northern Portuguese border with the Spanish province of Galicia and began setting up defensive positions. However, after the news of Napoleon's successful full-scale invasion of northern Spain, as well as the fall of Madrid, Moore now knew that his position in Galicia was untenable. Nevertheless, spies had alerted him to Marshal Soult's presence in nearby Lyon, and many of his forces were scattered throughout the countryside. Knowing this, Moore believed that he could deliver a blow to Napoleon's northern flank before retreating back into Portugal to regroup, buying them more time. Following minor skirmishes in the countryside, Moore sent the commander of his cavalry forces, Sir Henry Paget, to attack a French brigade made up of a cavalry regiment and a small platoon of dragoons at the small town of Sahagun, bringing us to the first engagement of the Coruña campaign, the Battle of Sahagun. On the night of December 20th and into the early morning of December 21st, a night which was described as bitterly freezing, Paget ordered a small cavalry regiment to enter the town, harass the French as they were preparing to sleep, and then he would take his larger cavalry regiment, the 15th Hussars, around the other side of the town to trap the French. However, the 1st Regiment was slow in getting to Sahagun for reasons that are not entirely clear, but whatever the reason, the French caught wind of the British movements and were able to escape out of the town without any harassment through the east. However, the frozen ground and bitter conditions made movement slow, and as dawn broke on the 21st, the British were able to narrow the gap. The French, under the command of General César de Bel, stopped their march and moved into formation. Paget then ordered a full-scale charge, which surprised some of the French soldiers, and they used their carbines to cut down scores of British cavalry, the horses included. And indeed, battle accounts of the day record the harrowing groans of man and horse alike, made all the more gruesome by the freezing temperatures as some men struggled to load and fire their rifles as their hands were frozen stiff. Nevertheless, the British were far more determined than the French, and despite being outnumbered nearly 2-1, were able to keep pushing the French back and eventually broke their lines, turning it into a rout as the French ran eastward. The British then pursued them heavily, capturing 13 officers and over 300 cavalrymen along with the horses. But the British had hoped to eliminate the regiment in its entirety, although one of their units, the 10th Hussars, were initially mistaken for French cavalry, slowing the pursuit and ultimately ending the battle. The Battle of Sahagun proved to be a minor victory for the British despite its overwhelming result. Moore's plan to pursue and cut off Soult was dashed when Napoleon had sent his main army north, halting Moore's advance dead in its tracks. The victory, though, did prove the superiority of the British hussars in battle, with their victory now making the French much more hesitant to fight with their cavalry in an open pitch battle during the rest of the Peninsular War, especially once Napoleon would leave the peninsula to the command of his brothers and marshals. Moore's advance also provided his Spanish allies valuable time to regroup and retreat, allowing them to fight another day. Even so, the reality of the situation was plain to see for Moore. He, too, needed to make the long trek back to the coast to avoid complete encirclement, capture, and likely capitulation. So, Moore turned his men around, and they headed west on the long, brutal, and arduous march to the Atlantic Ocean. Backing up a week, though, on the other side of Spain, in Catalonia, we need to circle back with General Laurent Sancerre, who is currently advancing on Barcelona following his victorious siege of Rosas the previous month, with French General Duhem desperately needing relief inside the Catalonian capital. Now, we mentioned numerous times in the series that Duhem was being besieged in the city, thanks in large part to the formidable blockade undertaken by Spanish General Juan Miguel de Vives and his 20,500-man infantry along with some cavalry. Vives, however, would soon need to divert some of those resources to the fast-approaching Sancerre, who made the perilous decision to approach the city from the mountains in the dead of winter with a combined Franco-Italian army and only 30 guns, bypassing Girona, knowing that he might need to besiege that city for a third time in the last year. Now, Sancerre made the difficult decision to leave most of his heavier artillery behind in order to increase his speed through the difficult terrain, but it proved effective because he caught the Spanish off guard with how quickly he was able to approach Barcelona. Once word reached Vives that Sancerre was nearing the city, he put a force together hastily of some 9,000 men and marched out to meet him. When the two armies met just outside of the town of Cardedeu, Sancerre, knowing time was of the essence given their limited rations, put on a masterclass in generalship at the Battle of Cardedeu. Both armies met at Cardedeu on December 16th, with Sancerre having the advantage of manpower by about 6,000 soldiers, but with extremely limited food rations. His men were starving and tired, but they were desperate to get to Barcelona by any means necessary, knowing that the city at least had shelter, relative warmth, and sufficient food supplies. Vives, on the other hand, was taken completely by surprise at Sancerre's speed, as well as the route he took. When Vives arrived on the morning of December 16th, he did so without a concrete battle plan of what he was going to do, especially defensively. Nevertheless, the multiple streams and tree groves in the area allowed both sides to take up ample defensive positions, as it was difficult for either side to discern enemy movements. As such, Vives deployed his first and second lines behind the Ria de Roca stream, with the second further uphill. He then had his guns scattered throughout the area, hidden by the tree cover. Sancerre, meanwhile, needed to make use of every piece of ammunition he had, knowing that they only had one chance to smash the Rivas' forces and reach Barcelona or be starved into submission. Sancerre was also still being pursued by the Spanish from the north, notably from Luis Roballedo de Palafox, the older brother of the aforementioned José de Palafox from our previous episodes on the Peninsular War. Thus, victory was the only option for Sancerre, as well as Duhem, and it needed to be a decisive one. So, he deployed 3 battalions to stay behind and defend his rear with the elder Palafox in pursuit, taking the other 23 to meet Vives head-on. In the van was Italian General Domenico Pino's division, followed by French General Joseph Souham's division. Pino was given strict orders from Sancerre to keep his men in formation as they would smash the Vives' first line. At no point, under any circumstances, was Pino to deploy battalions out of formation, not even to take high-valued prisoners. So, can you guess what happened next? Pino's advancing column then began to come under heavy fire from the nearby hills and the tree groves, causing them to panic. Now, while Pino did direct 2 battalions to attack the Spanish front line, with them even breaking through, they were stopped dead in their tracks by the second line, retreating back to the starting point while getting strafed the entire time. Sancerre, seeing the disaster unfold before him, galloped to the front of the line and changed tact in the blink of an eye. What unfolded next was nothing short of a complete and utter rout. Sancerre ordered Souham's division to attack the Spanish right flank, commanded by Swiss mercenary-turned-Spanish General Theodore von Redding, which relieved pressure off of Pino's jolted men, and then sent one of Pino's fresher brigades to charge at the Spanish center, commanded by Vives. Having 2 other battalions sent to the Spanish left to distract them, Souham's division quickly pierced through the Spanish right flank, causing it to buckle, which was further hampered by the quick surge of Pino's 2nd brigade through the Spanish center, breaking it in half. Now seeing his opportunity, Sancerre ordered his Italian light cavalry to charge the Spanish as they were caught on their heels, now going uphill. Seeing the horsemen quickly approaching, the Spanish panicked and began to retreat. In all, the Franco-Italian force suffered around 600 casualties, mostly Pino's initial charge, while the Spanish suffered nearly 3,000, including over 1,500 captured. Hearing the news of Sancerre's victory, the Spanish blockade of Barcelona ended, and many of the remaining Spanish and Catalonian forces escaped north, south, or to the east by boat. The commander of the Barcelona blockade, Raimundo Caldegas, even left a completely stocked food depot, which Sancerre's forces plundered the moment they seized it. Galdegas, for his part, would escape to Molins de Rey to the north. And remember that last bit, because it's going to be pretty important in about a minute. Sancerre would enter Barcelona the following day, December 17th, to what he thought would be groveling thanks by Duhem. But incredibly, Duhem famously dismissed Sancerre's arrival and even insisted that he could have held out for over a month. In fact, Duhem almost appeared surprised to see the relief force, believing it unnecessary, or rather insulting, to his ability as a commanding officer. Sancerre, furious at this response, reportedly showed Duhem a copy of one of his own messages pleading for assistance. Duhem then reportedly withdrew to his quarters in silence, with Sancerre incredulous that not a single French soldier in the city would even offer the simplest of thanks for their immeasurable effort to rescue them. He didn't have much time to dwell on his ire, though, because even with the Catalonian capital captured, about that alliteration, the Spanish would not give up so easily, and they resolved to make a final stand in the coming days. But unfortunately for them, as we've seen, Sancerre was ready for them. Now, I mentioned before that Galdegas had led the blockade of Barcelona, but he was technically third in the chain of command behind the aforementioned Vives and Reading, respectively. Vives, however, had fled following the battling of Cardedeu, and it was Reading who assumed command of the remnants of his forces, which numbered some 3,000 to 4,000 men. Now, eventually, he would unite with Galdegas at Molins de Rey, but both men were in a precarious position. While they wanted to retreat to the west, doing so would allow the French unfettered access to the Barcelona-Lleida highway, connecting East and West Catalonia. This essentially meant that the French would have split the autonomous region into two, while also having access to the fertile plains that ran along the road. Galdegas and Reding resolved to stop this to the best of their ability, and with Vives unresponsive on what to do next, they decided to stay and fight the French again to show the Catalan population that they would not be abandoned in vain. But unfortunately for the Spanish, it would turn into yet another rout. Hearing of the Spanish presence, Sancerre led four divisions out to meet them on the morning of December 21st, reportedly a cold and windy morning in the otherwise relatively mild Catalan winter. Now, for geographic context, Molins de Rey was only about 18 kilometers or 12 miles from the city center of Barcelona, so Sancerre had ample reason to want to drive the Spanish further away from his base of operations, in addition to creating a new strategic supply line. For the most part, Sancerre led with many of the same men he had fought with at Cardedeu, with each division being led by Generals Pinault, Souham, Joseph Chabon, and Louis Sabot. Chabot, the French, fought under the flag of the Kingdom of Naples, and their troops were widely regarded as some of the worst in all of Europe. Duhem, meanwhile, was left behind to defend Barcelona, since, apparently, he could have done that all by himself. In all, both sides fielded around 15,000 men. On paper, it seemed like an even fight, but the Battle of Molins de Rey would turn out to be anything but. Now, Sancerre knew that a single thrust on the main Spanish line would break them. So he decided to overextend them by sending Chabon and his 4,000-man division to the Spanish left flank at the Molins de Rey bridge straddling the Llobregat River. From here, Chabon would feint an attack while Sancerre sent the divisions of Pinault, Souham, and Chabot, combined totaling some 15,000 troops, to cross the lower fords of the river and come up on the Spanish right. When the attack began in the early morning hours of December 21st, Chabon's feint had worked as Sancerre had expected. Reading, who believed it to be the main French attack, moved some troops from his critical right flank over to the left to reinforce it. An hour later, Sancerre gave the signal, and the rest of his divisions advanced. As the French divisions now began to close in on the Spanish center and right, Reading's troops quickly became overextended. Pinault and Chabot, after crossing the river to the south, faced little opposition, crushing the minimum amount that they did. Souham was then ordered to direct his attack on the Spanish center, probably the toughest of the tasks, as the Spanish opposing him were all coming downhill to meet him. But in the chaos of the moment, combined with their hastily given orders, this proved disastrous, and the Spanish were unable to push their attack despite their geographical advantage. Eventually, Chabot, along with his worst in Europe Neapolitan soldiers, was able to sweep completely around the Spanish right, which meant that the Spanish fighting in the center now needed to turn back to help defend the rear, further breaking the line and forcing a mass of soldiers to head towards the left. Now, Chabon, for his part, noticed this wave of men approaching, giving him the opportunity to now lead a real assault on the Spanish left, boxing in the enemy line. But he hesitated on what to do. When he finally did give an order to advance, the Spanish had begun their retreat to the north, and with the river in their way, Chabon's men were unable to reach them in time. Vives, who would finally arrive following Cardedeu, saw the disaster unfolding and left before he could even offer up any form of resistance. Sancerre then ordered his dragoons to pursue the Spanish and to capture as many guns and horses as possible. Because, while it's impressive enough that Sancerre routed the Spanish as thoroughly as he did so with extremely weak artillery, much of it being captured Spanish guns from the campaign, as Sancerre, if we remember, ordered his men to ditch their heavy guns on their march to Barcelona. I guess having some full bellies after a long march truly does reawaken the inner monster in the Grande Armée. But, in any event, the French would add to their arsenal following the pursuit. Sancerre's men would capture 1,200 Spanish troops, including Caldegas, 25 guns, a magazine carrying over 3 million cartridges, and an untold number of abandoned muskets and carbines. The Spanish would also suffer over 1,000 killed or wounded, while the French would lose only 400. The Battle of Molins de Rei would be the last major battle in the Catalonian campaign until late February 1809 with the Battle of Valls. Now, Sancerre likely could have continued his pursuit of the Spanish, most of whom fled to Tarragona further south, but his troops were exhausted and he had, for the first time in months, secured stable food supplies. Sancerre even mentioned that his first priority was to ensure that his men were fed first, and that making sure he had a direct supply line to France was his second. Sancerre was also wary of the fact that Tarragona was heavily fortified and receiving British shipments directly into her ports. The situation on the ground was much more fluid, however. Catalonia was in a state of utter chaos. Most of the local population was turning into a quasi-feudal state, as many were looking for leaders while the military hierarchy, see Vives, was proving incompetent. And indeed, Vives would eventually be relieved of his duties for the foreigner Reding, who, if nothing else, had shown his bravery in battle, even if it was in complete disaster. But in hindsight, this proved to be a missed opportunity for Sancerre. Tarragona was actually lightly defended, and with the chaotic situation in Catalonia in general, he likely could have captured it, further reducing any resistance. In the end, the opposite happened. Sancerre's decision to stay pat, recuperate, and rest his troops, which, by the way, is completely understandable, gave the Catalans time to regroup. In just over a month, in late January of 1809, the army of Catalonia would number over 30,000 men, and they would be back to fight again. But, like I said, the Catalonian campaign would remain relatively quiet for the next few months. There was a small ambush on January 1st against General Reyes' troops near Girona at Castellón, but it did little to affect the overall campaign. As such, we're going to pick our story back up in the north of Spain, following Sahagún, as Mor began his long retreat back to the Galician coast. After the British victory and Soult's inability to cut down Mor's forces, Napoleon personally led his main army from Madrid to try and take matters into his own hands. Lord Paget, who was leading the British cavalry, was kept in the rear to perform screens in order to distract the Grande Armée of Mor's main army's movements. Between Christmas of 1808 to New Year's Day of 1809, Paget's cavalry faced numerous French assaults, all to be pushed back and countercharged in earnest. Now, while many of these skirmishes proved invaluable to British morale, it was the one at Benavente that gave the British hope that they could not only compete against Napoleon in battle, but beat him when they defeated the elite chasseurs à cheval of the Emperor's Imperial Guard. So let's talk about the small, but moderately consequential, Battle of Benavente. Following numerous minor skirmishes over the previous few days, Paget had many of his outlying forces stationed near Zamora on the River Elsa. Following heavy rains, which were typical of the Spanish winter, the Elsa had swollen, meaning that any bridges crossing it were of critical importance, as crossing it by foot or by horse was virtually impossible. The British destroyed the main bridge at Castro Gonzalo, but Napoleon sent General Lefebvre Dessaunay, a main player in the first siege of Zaragoza, to ford the river along with four squadrons of the Imperial Chasseurs, along with an additional Imperial squadron of the elite Mamelukes, which he did successfully on the morning of December 29th. This forced the British back onto inlying pockets along the river, creating a bottleneck. The 18th Hussars, led by General Loftus Otway, regarded as one of Britain's finest cavalry commanders in its history, did not want to become sitting ducks, and they charged directly at Lefebvre's men, only to be pushed back to the town of Benavente. However, on being pushed back, the British now suddenly had protection by the city walls in their flanks, and they then quickly counterattacked, which created instant chaos. The French were taken by surprise, and likely anticipated a second wave to come through from the city as if it were a trap. Nevertheless, they regrouped and pushed the British back again to the city, but the French should have indeed heeded their initial instincts because more British troops under Paget were there waiting for them. Now, just as the French thought that they were going to inflict the final blow, Paget arrived with the 10th Hussars, completely hidden from French view, and began to cut the French down from behind. As author Christopher Hibbert puts it in his book Coruña, the British cavalry were notorious for having dull swords due to the quality of their scabbards, or sheaths that they used. Now, while still lethal, as any experienced cook can tell you, nothing is worse than a dull knife, as it slows everything down and it's usually more dangerous to the user than to the subject it's being used on. However, at Benavente, the British swords were as sharp as Damascus steel, as they reportedly cut through the French arms, quote, like Berlin sausages, while also being able to deliver clean head blows that evenly slice chasseurs' heads like logs down at the neck. I hope everyone sleeps well tonight with that imagery. At this point, the French knew that there was little point in fighting back, and they began their orderly retreat back to the river, though few were successful in actually crossing it, and many were taken prisoner, including Lefebvre himself. Lefebvre wouldn't have it so bad, though. That evening, he was feted with praise by Moore and even dined with him, celebrating his bravery. Lefebvre would eventually be sent to England as a POW, where he would then eventually escape and return to France, breaking his parole set upon him by the royal authorities. Now, at the time, this was actually considered extremely dishonorable, and punishment by death was seen as appropriate not only by his captors, but by his home country. Nevertheless, Napoleon never surrendered him to the British, and eventually brought Lefebvre back into service upon his return to France. Speaking of Napoleon, the Emperor was actually present at the battle, watching from a nearby hill overlooking the action. Stunned at the result, he mourned the loss of some of his best cavalry, but he wasted no time in continuing his pursuit, motivated in part by the conclusion of Benavente. The British, on the other hand, were elated at what they perceived as further proof that they could hold up to the strength of the Grande Armée in an open battlefield, especially since they had just defeated one of Napoleon's best and most formidable fighting units. Nevertheless, their victory was underlined that they were still, in fact, being pursued by a massive French army under the command of Napoleon himself, and that pursuit would continue into the following day, when Marshal Soult would get some revenge by catching up to a small Spanish force under the command of La Ramona at the small village of Mansilla de las Mulas. Now, while Moore's army was being ferociously chased by Napoleon, La Ramona's corps was also trying to catch up with the British to aid in their retreat back to the coast. When La Ramona saw Soult approaching, he posted his rear guard at Mansilla to hold him off while they continued their rendezvous with Moore. Now, Mansilla, it sits on the banks of the Elsla River, a tributary of the great River Duero, and at the time there was a large bridge crossing it back onto the main road, which the rear guard was tasked with defending. Unfortunately, they posted their backs to the river, essentially eliminating any route of escape that they had, and Soult sent his cavalry, under the command of General Jean Franceschi, to cut them down, which he did, convincingly. In fact, many of Ramona's men were trapped against the river, which, in late December, was just above freezing, and they began to surrender en masse. The rest, unfortunately, were cut down, and the Spanish would lose over half of their 3,000-man force, while the French suffered fewer than 50 casualties. Now, while the Battle of Mansilla was minor, it did essentially leave all of León to the French forces, as La Ramona's army continued with their retreat to meet up with Moore. Mansilla would be the final battle during the 1808 campaign, with the next engagement taking place at Cacabelos on January 3rd, 1809. Now, before we get into the final two battles, spoiler alert, of the Coruña campaign, I want to level set in terms of what comes next for the Spanish theater as it relates to this podcast. Much of the fighting in 1809 would be scattered across Iberia, with the British, Spanish, and Portuguese now beginning their counteroffensive to reconquer the countries. Now, this included theaters in Portugal, southern and central Spain, and of course in Galicia, which is where we would see Vigo be the first city liberated from Napoleonic rule. Now, I mention all of this because we're going to be moving away from Spain after this episode and get ready for the quote-unquote big show, that is the War of the Fifth Coalition, and get back to the Napoleonic narrative. But we are going to come back to Spain in 1809, as this is where the true bloodletting begins in Napoleon's Spanish ulcer. But that is a few episodes away, so in the meantime, let's wrap up the Coruña campaign and the eventual fall of northern Spain to Napoleon's seemingly iron grip. Now, after Benavente, Napoleon was determined to double his efforts and catch Moore before he could reach Portugal, forcing him to an open pitch battle. Because Bonaparte knew that the closer Moore got to the coast, the more time it bought the British to ferry in reinforcements, or more likely, to evacuate the harassed troops with the hope of using them for later on in the war, something that Napoleon was certainly keen to avoid. A few minor setbacks notwithstanding, the brunt of the Grande Armée was still marching headlong to the sea, and Napoleon was determined to continue the initiative. Napoleon's march continued into the new year, with some estimates saying that his men covered over 200 miles, or 400 kilometers, in just over 10 days. Napoleon, in fact, was closing in on the British general, but on New Year's Eve, Moore, whose army was camping at Astorga, decided to make a final push towards the sea. Back in November, Moore had ordered a large portion of the British army in Portugal to march up to Vigo in Galicia and disembark, but with Napoleon determined as ever to finish the British off, Moore decided that it would be necessary for his men to join as well, and for them all to return back to Great Britain. As Napoleon entered Astorga on January 1st, he wrote to his brother Joseph back in Madrid, quote, "There could not have been a better sedative for Spain than to send an English army." But you see, what Napoleon didn't encounter in Astorga was the British army. 2 days too late, the French emperor then made the decision to leave the pursuit in its entirety to Soult, with Marshal Ney in support from the rear with about 16,000 troops, taking the remaining 50,000 back with him to Madrid in order to attend to other pressing matters, mainly the rising threat of Austria on the eastern frontier of his empire. He wanted to ensure that when he left Spain in complete control of his older brother, he would do so under the pretense that it would be in good hands and under full Bonapartist control. But, as we've seen already, and we will soon see again, the only trait that Joseph would share with Napoleon would be his last name. With Napoleon's main force now backtracking to Madrid, and again in brutal conditions after having just trekked from Madrid within a 3 days' march of the coast, Soult assumed command and continued the pursuit. Moore, meanwhile, was now camping north at Villafranca, wanting to make contact with his rear guard, led by General Edward Paget, as many of his troops were beginning to grow restless with the retreat. Starving, freezing, and with morale plummeting by the day, rioting was beginning to break out, delaying the march and forcing Moore's rear to fall further behind as Soult closed in. Arriving at the village town of Cacabelos on the River Cúa, Paget's men needed to cross a double-arched stone bridge to meet up with the rest of Moore's army. Now, this choke point further slowed the march, and on January 3rd, Paget got word that the French cavalry was approaching, led by Brigadier General Auguste-François-Marie de Colbert-Chabanet. Colbert, who had turned 31 only 3 months prior, had distinguished himself during the battles of Elkingen, Jena, Eylau, and Friedland, all while leading the cavalry under Ney's 6th Corps. Now under Soult's command, leading the advance guard's cavalry, Colbert had personally led the capture of some 2,000 prisoners and additional baggage trains, while closely following Moore's rear guard. Making contact with the British at Cacabelos that same day, he'd assumed the element of surprise would give him the advantage. But unfortunately for Colbert, it wound up being his last stand. Now, initially, Colbert's cavalry captured an additional 50 British troops who were completely unaware of the French advance until first contact. Assuming that he could press the advantage, Colbert continued forward, doing so without, critically though, infantry or artillery support. Approaching the bridge, Colbert was met with heavy fire from the 95th Rifles, an elite sharpshooting regiment that was still in disciplined fighting shape when compared to the rest of Paget's rearguard. Moore, who had nearly been captured by Colbert only hours earlier, watched the action from a nearby hill as his gunners mowed down Colbert's cavalry, decimating their ranks and sending them fleeing. One of the shots was fired by Irish rifleman Thomas Plunkett, and it hit Colbert from nearly 200 meters away, a considerable distance even for the rifles of the day to hit those targets so accurately. Colbert's last words were, quote, "I'm still very young to die, but at least my death is that of a soldier of the great army. Because, exhaling, I see flee the last and eternal enemies of my country. Marshal Ney, upon hearing of his death later that day, was devastated. He had previously stated during the Ulm campaign that he always slept well, knowing that Colbert would be defending his posts. Napoleon would later honor Colbert for his service, and his name would be inscribed in the Arc de Triomphe in Column 38. Their commanding officer now dead, the French did try to regroup for one final push across the bridge, but darkness began to fall by 4 p.m., and with their morale dashed by the loss of Colbert, the French relented. Paget would continue on, and they would reach Villafranca the next morning without any of the French advance guard in pursuit. Cacabelos would be the last major battle of the Coruña campaign until the ultimate battle itself 2 weeks later. Its overall effect on the campaign was minimal, though it dealt another blow to the French morale with the loss of one of its finest cavalry officers. From now until Coruña, it would be a battle not of fire and iron, but of will. Over the following week, both Moore and Soult had, at various times, prepared their armies for battle, waiting on reinforcements to further solidify their positions, only to each be strung out by either weather, poor troop conditions, or inadequate support. On January 8th, Soult even tried to engage Moore directly, but Moore, anticipating being outflanked by Ney, decided to avoid it again and slipped away during the night, killing lame horses and abandoning damaged artillery wagons. Freeing themselves of the dead weight, they continued on to the coast. Moore had originally intended a rendezvous with the British troops arriving north from Portugal at Vigo on Galicia's west coast, but with the state of the army being what it was and the relentless pursuit of Soult, he sent orders instead to make for Coruña on the north shore, with the naval transport fleet instructed to change course immediately to assist in the evacuation. But when the British finally arrived at Coruña on January 11th, their fleet was nowhere to be found. Unbeknownst to Moore, though, the 250 or so ships ordered from Britain to assist in the evacuation were thrown off course by contrary winds on their way to the original destination, Vigo. Once they finally arrived at port on the 8th, they wouldn't receive word of Moore's last-minute instructions until later that day and needed a resupply before making the short trip up the coast to La Coruña. As a result, they would not leave Vigo's port until January 13th, leaving Moore's army a sitting duck until the main fleet could arrive. But it wasn't all bad, because the British used their arrival at Coruña to restock, and when Soult's men began to trickle in from the mountains, Moore's army began to fortify Coruña for the evacuation, waiting for the rest of their fleet to arrive. Incredibly, aided by northerly winds and pure determination, the British evacuation fleet would reach Coruña on January 14th, and Moore ordered boarding to begin immediately for the sick, injured, and cavalry, just as Soult's main army began to reach the city. Now, speaking of Soult, his army wasn't exactly in the best shape. Following the same path that the British had trodden, the French advance guard and cavalry were constantly getting pushed back by the stubborn rear of the British. And because of this, despite their advance guard arriving at the outskirts of Coruña on the same day as the British, Soult's main army would arrive piecemeal over the following 3 days. Now, this meant that when they were all finally together on January 14th, some had a few days to rest and recover, while the vast majority did not. Unlike the British, who had spent the better part of 3 days and nights eating, sleeping, and recovering from what was later described by some British veterans as the hardest campaign of all the Napoleonic Wars. But when Soult did arrive, he could see the British masts in the harbor, and he knew that he needed to fight or risk losing Moore's entire army to the sea. Now Moore, for his part, knew that his men would need to fight Soult in order to successfully launch the evacuation. You see, given the geographic setting of Coruña, his decision to board the cavalry turned out to be a good one in hindsight because horses would not have proven very effective in the rocky terrain of the area. Moore also possessed the superior manpower advantage, 15,000 to 12,000, and his men were energized, well-fed, and had just received fresh ammunition. And so, on January 15th, Moore prepared his men for battle, and it turned out to be the last one that the British general would ever fight. Now, to help further stall any French advance, thus buying more time for the evacuations, Moore sent the majority of his infantry on a ridge about a mile and a half south of the harbor at a point called Montemero. Now, the area was full of hills, olive groves, and thick brush, making cavalry movements almost impossible except to the extreme west, which would further delay French advances and buy the British even more time for the boarding of the ships. Moore also held two divisions in reserve to cover their right flank, west of the main army's position, to help defend against any French envelopment. Moore then sent his advance guard forward to harangue Soult, but the French marshal would push them back before taking up positions on the nearby heights outside the city, overlooking Moore's position. Soult had intended to keep pressing on, attacking the British line, cutting it off from the rear, and then pushing the British back towards the bay, but the weather and difficult terrain slowed their advance, and they wouldn't be able to mount their attack until the next day, January 16th. And that, folks, brings us, finally, to the final piece of our campaign puzzle, the Battle of Coruña. The following morning, Soult's men were finally in position, but having set up all through the night, they were exhausted. Now, Moore's men were also in position, anticipating an attack at any moment, and so Soult's plan was relatively straightforward. Concentrate their advance on the British center and left, or the French right, while using another infantry division under General Julien Mermet to attack the weaker British right, while then sending the cavalry under General Armand Lebrun de la Houssaye to cut off Moore's retreat to the city, pushing them further to the coast, where they would then be picked apart. Now, this plan centered on Mermet taking the critical village of Elvigna, which, over the course of the battle, would see some of the heaviest fighting during the day. Moore, for his part, had been expecting a French advance, but when the morning passed without any noticeable movements, he began to order some of his divisions back to the city to continue boarding the awaiting ships. Moore had, incorrectly, assumed that since Soult had not attacked yet, that he didn't have sufficient forces to begin battle, and he wanted to try to use this supposed bought time to continue evacuations with his fresher troops. By mid-morning, he had ordered some 3,000 soldiers back to the city for their disembarkment under the command of General Edward Paget. But just as Paget was arriving at Coruña, Moore noticed that Soult had begun concentrating his cavalry on the far right of the British line at Santa Margarita Heights, startling him, and he urgently called back to Paget to reverse course. Just as his orders were sent out, Moore began to hear gunfire in the distance. Soult ordered his artillerymen to begin shelling the British positions, and the British general's realization came to fruition. The Battle of Coruña had officially begun. As initially planned, Soult sent Mermet's infantry division forward towards Elvigna, and the French quickly pushed back the British PKs while taking the city as well as the heights beyond it. Now initially, it had looked like it was going to be a French rout, but Moore, knowing that if they lost Elvigna, they would be completely cut off, personally took two infantry regiments down to the village himself to halt the French advance. Now Elvigna, much like the rest of the small Spanish towns at the time, contained numerous stone walls and uneven hollowed roads. This made fighting in formations almost impossible, and so there was a lot of confusion on both sides as to how to continue to press on or to push back. Now this forced a lot of fighting in the outskirts of the village, and Elvigna would change hands several times over the course of the day, seeing the heaviest fighting for ownership of its critical position. The British, though, suffered greatly at the start of the battle, as the French artillery had optimal positions on the hills, allowing them to rain hellfire on enemy infantry. Nevertheless, the British were determined as ever to hold the town, and Moore, in what would be the last action of his life, would not go quietly into the night. As Moore was arriving at Elvigna, Soult had now ordered his reserves and Houssaye's cavalry on the far French left to begin closing in on the British center. Seeing that the battle for the town was becoming bogged down in attrition fighting, Soult was hoping that this would be the final blow needed to encircle the village and begin their final charge towards Coruña's ports. But, just as Houssaye's men had made the turn right, Paget's men were arriving from their hasty return from Coruña. And Moore, in what was likely the last order he ever gave, instructed Paget, along with General Alexander Mackenzie Fraser's reserves, to rush to Houssaye's cavalry to cover their left flank. But as soon as Moore gave the order, a cannonball struck the British general, mortally wounding him by slicing through his collarbone and leaving his right arm hanging onto his torso by a few shreds of muscle and skin. And as crazy as it may sound, Moore did not die instantly. In fact, he continued to will his soldiers on as he lay on the ground for the next several hours, bleeding out and eventually succumbing to his wounds. He was 47 years old. Perhaps crazier still was that the British were without a superior commanding officer for the better part of the afternoon, as Moore's second-in-command, General Baird, was also badly wounded during the initial shelling. It wouldn't be until Paget arrived at the town that order was restored. Well, relatively speaking, anyway. Meanwhile, Houssaye's cavalry was slowed in their advance on Elvigna by the rough terrain, which gave Paget and eventually Fraser time to catch up. When Houssay finally arrived at the village, they were able to push the British back, but their slow advance allowed Paget and Fraser to counterattack on the French left. Hard fighting by the British infantry against the French dragoons further impeded Houssay's advance, and he then ordered a retreat from the town, fearing that they would be enveloped by Paget's forces. Despite the superior French numbers in both manpower and artillery, they couldn't allow their line to break and risk annihilation. Soult had wanted to reform the line and counterattack, but with nightfall quickly approaching, remember mid-January has some of the shortest days of the year in the Northern Hemisphere, both sides eventually fell back to their original positions. The French would suffer around 1,000 casualties, while the British suffered slightly higher numbers at around 1,300 to 1,500, depending on estimates. Now, while nightfall technically brought an end to the Battle of Coruña, the British were not out of the water yet. With Moore now dead, command passed to General John Hope, who ordered the embarkation to continue at once. Now, there had been some trepidation about undertaking such a large escape in such a short amount of time, as Soult was now positioning his cannons to besiege the ports, leaving a large congregation of British soldiers in a single section of the city extremely vulnerable to devastating artillery fire. Thus, some in the British command had wanted to hold out and fortify the city and do a slow withdrawal, but Hope, seeing the state of his army, as well as seeing their morale drop following the loss of their commanding officer, decided against this. Waiting until after 9 p.m., when they had the full cover of darkness, they began to fully withdraw from their lines and board the ships. As day broke on the 17th, most of the remaining British army had left port. When Soult got word of this, he ordered his cannons to fire on the remaining transport ships, causing some of them to run aground in the shallow harbor. Some of the accompanying Spanish troops that formed a part of the British rear stayed behind to help fend off Soult while allowing the last of the British soldiers to leave port, but by the 18th, Soult and his army had forced the city to fully capitulate. Marching into Coruña as the head of a conquering army, the residents of the city pretended to ignore the French presence in a silent act of defiance. But, alas, the outcome was absolute. La Coruña, and by extension, northern Spain, had fallen to the French. Over the next 2 weeks, Marshal Soult and Ney began to fortify the rest of Galicia, preparing for their next major campaign, the March on Portugal to retake that stubborn country that started this entire war. Well, according to Napoleon anyway, but we'll get to the Portugal campaign a little later on. For now, let's wrap up Coruña and put a bow on the first part of the Peninsular War before we return to France in our following episode. The Battle of Coruña, and really the entire campaign, was technically a French victory, albeit one that was achieved at a high cost and didn't bring the ultimate result that Napoleon had hoped for, which was the destruction of the British army and the complete capitulation of Spain. Far from it, in fact. Moore, albeit in a somewhat of a blundering fashion, did achieve a defensive victory to defend his as well as his army's honor by holding Soult off just long enough to allow his men the ability to fight another day. Even Soult admired the fighting spirit of Moore, ordering his grave to be taken care of properly with full military honors, and for a monument to be erected in his name. From the French position, even despite the fact that they had emerged as conquerors of northern Spain, they were surprised at how much they had to work to achieve that victory. And by the time February 1809 arrived, they were exhausted, still needing to recuperate from the brutal march that they had made to the Atlantic Ocean. But in Britain, it was a completely different story. Moore's handling of the campaign back home was seen at best as utter incompetence and at the worst, pure cowardice. And in Spain, the Spanish would welcome Moore into their country hoping that he would be their savior. Well, they were left white with shock at how quickly he was turned around and sent back to the ocean. At that moment, it looked pretty bleak for every Iberian and really anyone else in Europe who crossed Napoleon's path. But as history has shown us, decisions cannot be judged in a single moment. And Moore's decision to disembark his troops on that cold January day would prove to be a critical one in Napoleon's downfall over the next 6 years. Speaking of Napoleon, the day after Soult marched his corps into Coruña, the French emperor got into his carriage and left Spain, never to return again. He had urgent business to attend to back in Paris, after all, because while he was away straightening his army up in Spain, coup plots, assassination threats, and the growing threat of another coalition war were waiting for him back in the French capital. As such, he made the fateful decision to leave the Peninsular War in the hands of his marshals and, gulp, his brother. But we'll get to that when we get back to Spain. But that will be in a few more episodes because we are, finally, returning to France. And next time, will lay the groundwork for the last war Napoleon would win. Join us as we begin, finally, setting the stage for the War of the Fifth Coalition.